Okay, let's call this meeting back to order so we can move into item number six. The department's role in forest habitat protection, forest practices. And this is a briefing. The staff before us, David Whipple and Terry Jackson. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the commission. Director Anderson and Director Storr. My name is David Whipple. I'm the Forest Policy Coordinator for the department. I work in the Habitat Program, and I'll let Terry introduce herself.
Okay, I'm Terry Jackson. I'm in the Habitat Program. I'm the Forest Habitat Section Manager, and I serve on the Policy Committee for Forest and Fish.
So what we're going to do today is hopefully fairly briefly and give you some information and a presentation on forest habitats and how the department and then specifically the habitat program works to conserve and protect these habitats. So, and I know we're behind schedule, so we'll try to be brief without being too brief because it's a relatively complex world that we work in, and we don't want to skip over too much, but nonetheless, we'll try to move as quickly as we can. So here's a quick outline of what we're going to be talking about, and we're going to be doing a bit of a tag team. I'll introduce the topics, go through some background information. Terry's going to talk about the aquatic resources, and then I'll talk about the terrestrial resources. So why is it important? The short answer is pretty easy to see that over half the state is forested. It equates to 22 million acres, and our world really resides in the state and private forest lands of the state, which is over 10 million acres of forest land, and that's really the arena that we work in for the most part. We do work a little bit on the federal forest issues, but not nearly as much. And the other reason, really, from the resource perspective, why it's important, are there a very large number of species, as you probably know, that are dependent upon forests. Many state and federal listed species, as well as candidates, and also species that are sensitive to forest practices and forest management, but are not listed. And those also include game species for which the commission is responsible for. So I'm going to give you a really quick rundown on some of the key history pieces and the framework within which we operate. And the first big milestone was really in 74, and that was when the Forest Practices Act was passed. That was relatively simple at that point in time. It really had a lot to do with requiring reforestation after timber harvest to try to alleviate the issue of people cutting and running, so to speak. But that really set the stage for a lot of litigation over natural resource protection in the forest and environment between 74 and, say, 87. And the Timber, Fish, and Wildlife Agreement is really a foundational piece that we operate under today. And that agreement was a negotiated agreement amongst all of the stakeholders, all the state agencies, the tribes, the conservation groups, federal agencies, I believe, were there, and importantly, the timber industry. And so that agreement was a way to try to get away from litigation and get away from unsatisfactory court decisions and solve things amongst the stakeholders themselves and come up with a negotiated agreement that works for everybody. So that's really what laid the foundation for one of the more recent pieces, and that's the Forest and Fish Agreement. And that was based on the fact that the salmon listings were coming down, and again, the TFW world, the Timber, Fish, and Wildlife world, wanted to craft their own solution to the salmon listings. And instead of waiting for a federal decision or even court decision. And one of the important things about that is that agreement negotiated provided us, Department of Fish and Wildlife, a seat on the Forest Practices Board, which regulates state and private forest lands in the state, something that we've never had before. And there were a set of rules that were passed to implement the law, and then finally in 05, that wound up being transformed into a habitat conservation agreement that or plan that we are operating under today. So that was the aquatic side of things. And then a little bit more recently, the Forest Practices Board endorsed a wildlife work plan that I'll talk about a little bit more in detail in a few minutes. But that was really the kind of the corollary to forest and fish, although with a different context. So who are the stakeholders? As you might imagine, it's everybody. And we are primarily involved providing expertise on fish and wildlife habitat requirements, ecology, etc., and the various other entities there you probably know about. Ecology from a clean water perspective, Department of Natural Resources implements the forest practice rules. We also have a lot of interplay with the federal services, both industrial and small forest landowners, counties, tribes, and of course the conservation organizations. So central to how we operate really on state and private forest lands is through the Forest Practices Board. And it was established in 74 by the Act. It's chaired by the Commission, Commissioner of Public Lands. It's a 13-member board. And their role really is to do a couple of main things, is protect public resources while maintaining a viable timber industry. Public resources are defined as water, fish, wildlife, capital improvements of the state. So they adopt rules, but they also adopt non-regulatory approaches to protection that I'll touch on in a minute. And this is just simply a display of kind of a little bit of the dichotomy involved in terms of have the board having control over both aquatic and upland resources. The forest and fish is the big piece under aquatic. And then the approaches to protect upland wildlife reside really both in species-specific rules that I'll touch on and habitat protections. But the forest and fish piece is really a habitat-based approach. And so now Terry will go through and explain the forest and fish side of the world.
Okay, before I tell you about the role we play in forest and fish, I'd like to give you just a little brief background. Because of the many species listed under the Federal Endangered Species Act, and because of the waters across the state that are on the 303D list for water quality issues, the two primary goals of forest and fish was to obtain ESA and Clean Water Act assurances. The other primary goals were to restore and maintain harvestable levels of fish and to maintain a viable timber industry. And in order to achieve these federal assurances, in 2006, a habitat conservation plan was adopted based on the new forest and fish rules. And this is the largest programmatic HCP in the nation. It covers close to 10 million acres of forest land and over 60,000 miles of stream. It covers all fish species inhabiting stream habitats and seven riparian-dependent amphibians. It's also based on a science and a strong adaptive management program. And it's important to note that Department of Fish and Wildlife forest lands are also covered under this HCP. These rules are based on riparian functions in order to meet the resource objectives, and you can see what these functions are and that they're very critical for protection of fish habitat. Department of Fish and Wildlife plays a major role in forest and fish in a whole lot of aspects. And David's already mentioned to you our role on the board. So I'd like to highlight just some of the other important roles that we play. The Adaptive Management Program is a very formal and scientific-based program. It's made of two major entities, the Forest and Fish Policy Committee and the Cooperative Monitoring and Evaluation and Research Committee, or better known as CEMER. And the Policy Committee considers the findings of CEMER, of the science and research, and it recommends changes or modifications to the rules and guidance as necessary to protect aquatic resources. And the Cooperative Monitoring, Evaluation, and Research Committee conducts the research and monitoring to evaluate whether those rules are actually meeting those resource objectives. And I'd like to mention that our habitat scientists play a major role on CEMER. They actually even lead some of the more important research projects on that committee. Another important role we play is in compliance monitoring. We have a habitat biologist who works on a multi-stakeholder team to conduct field assessments for compliance monitoring and to also assess where operational improvements can be made on the ground. Small forest landowners, they make up like over 3 million acres across the state. And on this map, you can see them in dark green. And we put a lot into trying to help the small forest landowners because they are disproportionately impacted by the rules, both economically and because the rules are complex and hard for them to implement. And so we work with various stakeholders, both at the policy, the technical, and the legislative levels. We help to develop alternative prescriptions that they protect the resource, but they can be less costly and easier to implement for them. And we also work on financial assistance and incentives for them. And one of the great examples of financial assistance for the small forest landowners is the Family Forest Fish Passage Program. And this is a cost share program that helps to eliminate fish passage barriers on small forest landowners' land. And since 2003, the state's invested over $19 million in this program. We've eliminated over 240 fish passage barriers and opened up over 500 miles of fish habitat. And we also have habitat staff that work in this program as well, assessing in the field and prioritizing these proposed projects and working with other partners to actually implement these projects. And then another very important role we play is in implementation on the ground. And this is a lot of where our regional forest and fish biologists and staff come into play. They issue hydraulic project approvals for all forest practices hydraulic projects with fish-bearing streams, and this includes water crossing structures that provide for fish passage. And in a moment, I'll be talking to you about, just briefly, how we conduct forest practices hydraulic projects will be changing dramatically in 2014, and I'll talk to you about that in a moment. Stream typing provides the basis of where and to what degree riparian buffer protection is applied on the ground, which also protects fish habitat. And in 2012, or last year, our biologists reviewed over 3,000 water type modification proposals to assure that those streams were typed correctly and for the so that fish habitat would be protected on the ground. And I'm sure you've heard of road maintenance and abandonment plans that even our agency falls under on forest lands. All landowners are required by law to submit road maintenance and abandonment plans that provide an inventory of their fish passage barriers as well as other road upgrades. And our staff has helped in this area by helping landowners to identify those fish passage barriers as well as helping to prioritize them on a worst first basis. And then for all other forest practice applications, our staff screen those applications for other fish and wildlife concerns. Okay, as I mentioned to you, how we do business with hydraulic projects on forest lands is going to change dramatically as of 2014. And in last year's legislation, Senate Bill 6406 mandated that fish protection standards from our hydraulic code be integrated into forest practice rules. And this was to be done by December of 2013. So once that occurs, all Forest Practices hydraulic projects and HPAs, as we've known them before, will be incorporated into Forest Practice applications. And at that time, it will be under DNR's authority as far as we won't be issuing those permits anymore at that time. However, though we won't be issuing the permits, the workload for our staff will remain the same or even be greater, especially for the first so many years. What it will mean for us is that we'll continue to review and comment on all Forest Practices hydraulic projects. We'll continue to work with applicants both on the ground and with DNR to assure that these projects and the designs meet fish protection standards. And we'll be coordinating with DNR on all Forest Practices hydraulic projects. And we're really, the key to success for this whole thing is that we establish a very close relationship with DNR and have a team approach with them on this.
Thanks, Terry. So now we'll shift gears and talk briefly about some of the policy and technical and implementation work that we do in terms of upland wildlife habitat conservation. So here's the diagram again of the board and the protections that we negotiate for upland wildlife. Again, take on a couple of different kind of flavors. One of them is the strict regulatory approach. The other one is one that we've been working probably more so lately in recent years than ever, and that's non-regulatory or at least non-rule-based approaches to habitat protection, working directly with the landowners, trying to provide them incentives, et cetera. And then I'll talk a little bit about the wildlife work plan that is kind of has touchstones in both of those other two boxes. So how do regulations or conservation non-regulatory approaches come to be? Well, a lot of them initiate from state and federal listings or critical habitat designations. And so there is a connection between this commission and the Forest Practices Board, because if a new species is listed or it changes status, what that does is it triggers a consultation between our department and the Department of Natural Resources, and we make a recommendation to the Forest Practices Board whether or not any new rules or rule changes might be necessary. New science or policy comes to bear, as well as outright citizen petitions to the board to adopt rules to provide protections. There are a number of upland wildlife rules that protect T&E species, threatened and endangered species, and also the other kind of the side of the coin are rules that protect individual either habitats or habitat features on the landscape. And so you might think of probably the most well-known species are the spotted owl and marbled murrelet. There are rules on the books for those particular species. And as an example of a non-regulatory based approach, when the lynx was listed, we did talk about a regulatory approach for that particular species. But what it came down to is negotiating landscape plans with the individual landowners that owned the majority of the lynx range in the state. And they developed these plans with us, we approved them, and they implement them, and it's all a landscape shifting mosaic type of an approach to providing habitat for that species. So in that case, it was really a good fit. And in the case of the Taylor's checkerspot butterfly, fairly recently the board adopted a non-rule-based approach for that as well, where Department of Fish and Wildlife negotiates management plans with the individual landowners that have those types of sites on their property. So we do both. We also have on the Forest Practices rules specific rules for elements like snags, dead trees, green recruitment trees, logs, etc., that provide habitat. And at the bottom of the slide there, the riparian areas, we just heard about the forest and fish rules that provide habitat for the aquatic species. So just to give you a quick view of the scope of some of these rules, probably the widest scope is the northern spotted owl rule. What you'll see in the in the pink or the purple color are 11 spotted owl special emphasis areas. And while those areas include roughly 1 million acres across the state, that strategy is doesn't protect all of the habitat within that. It just focuses the efforts of where spotted owls get protection and their habitat gets protected. And that that rule is a prime example of how all of the stakeholders came together to negotiate a solution that, in this case, it was really important to tier off from the federal recovery plan and make sure that the state was doing its part to help implement the federal recovery plan where needed. And that's why you see the purple areas adjacent to the federal lands that are in green. So that's kind of a rough overview of how we operate, at least in the rural development stage of things. And then we, like forest and fish, as Terry mentioned, we also have implementation roles to implement the rules on the ground. And we don't have a lot of staff working on that because of budget cuts over the years. But what we do is we do screen the forest practice applications for high priority species like owls, murrelets, etc. And we provide assistance in typing the habitat, making sure the rules get implemented properly. DNR looks to us as experts, and in fact there are a number of statutes and rules that require them to consult with us to make sure that we're identifying the right habitat and we're implementing the rules as intended. We also help the wildlife program conduct surveys for species when we can. And we also obviously coordinate expertise on any litigation or forest practices appeals. So DNR taps into our agency for those items as well. A little bit on the wildlife work plan. So this is the Forest Practices Board's work plan. So this is it has four elements. The first element is a review of the existing rules that are already on the books, and those assessments are meant to key in on identifying how well the current rules are working for threatened and endangered species. And the second element then was this concept of building state-of-the-art habitat models that not only model existing conditions for forest-dependent species across the landscape, and this focused on non-listed species. So it was an effort to keep common species common or to prevent listings in the future. And the great thing about that effort was that it modeled existing conditions, but also as the forest and fish rules get implemented over time and the riparian areas that are fairly significant, as they grow and mature in age, there's going to be a lot of contribution to upland species to those from those areas as well. So it was a way to kind of quantify that, to see where we are now and where we're headed in the future. That effort, it needs funding help to get accomplished, but we're pursuing that. The other couple of elements, I already mentioned incentives a little bit. Any gaps that are identified anymore, we talk not only about rules, but also how to incentivize landowners to do the right thing, either through conservation easements or some kind of regulatory incentive. Adaptive management is always there in the background, depending upon what the need is, specific to an individual, either species or habitat. So that's kind of the regulatory world, and we also operate in kind of outside the context of the Forest Practice Board and the regulations to achieve conservation. One of the biggest examples is that the Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA Fisheries and actually individual landowners really have looked to our agency to provide expertise and input on sound strategies for habitat conservation plans. They recognize that if we're not on board, they're probably not going to get very far with the general public in terms of acceptance under a public review scenario. So we've been involved with all of these habitat conservation plans that cover over 2 million acres in this state. So in the light blue is what you're looking at for the HCP areas, and I think it's, I believe that may only encompass DNR's HCP and not all the rest of them, but DNR's is by far the biggest. So we've had a really significant impact there. And kind of winding down now, I did want to mention a few other arenas that we work in that are not related to regulatory approaches in the Forest Practices Board. We are involved with our own agency lands in terms of habitat management and restoration projects, but also the forest plan that's being developed and the habitat conservation plan that we have for our own property. So they recognize that we bring habitat expertise, but also expertise and knowledge in terms of what's acceptable amongst the TFW stakeholders and how to kind of navigate that whole process. Forest biomass is another emerging industry, as you may know, especially on the east side in terms of the forest health issues, fire risk, etc. And we're involved with that process to the extent that we can in terms of trying to make sure that we kind of allow this industry to move forward without having negative effects on fish and wildlife. But this is a prime opportunity for some forest restoration work. So again, landowner incentives I've already touched on. Ecosystem services is kind of one of those types of landowner incentives that we're it's an emerging market and issue that we're trying to get into. So real quickly, in summary, I just want to leave you folks with the concept that we only touched on a little bit of this really big, complex world that covers millions of forested acres. We provide a lot of expertise, both in terms of technical and operational, but also policy and negotiation. And the goal is really to derive sustainable solutions for natural resource protection in the forested environment. Then on the process side of things, we're a key player, as you've heard, in the Timber, Fish, and Wildlife Agreement in the arena. We still operate under that scenario, and in the forest and fish world, what that really means is because the state has the HCP for forest practices for aquatic resources, we're one of the key people that kind of keep that thing running, and there's a lot of momentum behind that. In closing, you know, we've often hear the forest industry say that, you know, Washington has the most restrictive forest practice rules in the country, and the Forest and Fish Agreement rules and HCP is a really huge deal. It's a big burden to those folks. On the other hand, they repeat over and over again how that agreement has provided them with regulatory stability, which they hold very high and very, very important. And so it's a difficult relationship at times negotiating those solutions, but it works out and it's a sustainable solution. So we would like to thank you for your time and offer to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you very much. Very good presentation. Commissioner Perry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Your presentation was really good, and I actually learned quite a bit about your function. And I think protection of habitat resources is extremely important, as you pointed out. However, I think that managing forest resources is also an extremely important thing to the natural environment. Through succession, things change all the time, and I don't think you can necessarily walk away from an area. You've got to watch it and manage it for the best habitat for the wildlife you're interested in that area. And you just briefly touched on the management aspect in the last part of your talk. And I wondered how you view, just as an example, the lack of recovery of white-tailed deer in northeastern Washington. And a lot of people feel that that's because of the lack of forest management in that area, also changes in cropping patterns on private ground and so forth. Protection always seems to me like you put a fence around it and don't do anything. And I feel management is really critical, and particularly in that instance. How do you folks deal with a situation like that?
Well, in terms of management for game species, deer, elk, et cetera, the forest practices rules don't enter into that arena directly. But from the protection standpoint, you know, your comment about putting a fence around it, that isn't necessarily accurate either, depending upon the species. But we fully understand that management is needed and to keep forest healthy, for one, and to provide habitat for game species, for two. The forest practices regulatory arena just doesn't enter into requiring state and private landowners to do active management for, say white-tailed deer in this situation. And I guess I would offer that probably on state and more so on private lands, that I would assume anyway, without knowing a lot about that particular topic, that the habitat is probably in a lot better shape on the private lands than it is, say, on federal lands, where there is less management going on over the past couple of decades now. And so that's an arena that we don't focus a lot of time as far as the federal forest management, but it is something that happens really more so in within the own individual regions of DFW, working with individual forests to achieve whatever priority goals that they have in terms of game species.
Thank you.
Commissioner Jennings?
Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Terry, you were talking about the change in the hydraulic permit process and that DNR will be the lead, signature on the permit in the future, but that our agency will be required to do as much or more work. Mm-hmm. Are there issues around us getting properly fiscally supported for those staff to do that work? Have we lost our ability to raise revenue with this new approach? I know you have been briefed on it before, but this sort of brought the question back up. If we're not signing the permit, how do we recover our costs for doing the work?
Well, actually, we do have several contracts through pass-through money through DNR. It doesn't cover all of our staff by any means. And starting this new fiscal year for implementation, it will be more or less three staff, but then we also have one, our compliance monitoring person gets funded as well separately. So those are discussions we're having. We don't get revenue from those hydraulic projects anymore. There'll be FPA fees, and I mean, we'll be having discussions with DNR in the future as far as how we get our work done with the different staffing. As far as the FPA fees for that, we just haven't figured all that out yet. Okay. But we're definitely not funded adequately for all the staff that participate in this.
Great. And then on slide 31, David, you talked about T&E species. Is that federal or state listings?
That that would apply to both.
Okay.
So whether or not if a species is listed just by the state or just by the federal government or both, it triggers the same kind of review and look and consideration of protection.
One of the nice things this department did 10 or 12 years ago was around the spotted owl habitat. And we'd had rules in place in the 90s, sort of looking at spotted owl circles, not having to deal with them. And you guys came back as a department and really looked at the change over time in the 90s in Southwest Washington. It was a real eye-opener for a lot of people to see what we thought were relatively effective rules back then functionally did not turn out to be nearly as effective as we thought when we looked at the habitat left, you know, at the end of the 90s. And I think that sort of helped drive some of the discussions. In a similar way, we're looking at what's going on with marbled murrelets, and at least in Washington State, the trends don't look good. The overall trends, you know, a little bit of variation year to year, but just hearing at the Wildlife Committee that on our outer coast, for example, they're looking at a 7.6% annual rate of decline over the past 10 years. And what that's saying is if we had 100 birds 10 years ago, we'd have less than 30 now, and the trend doesn't look good. And there has to be some sort of habitat component to that. It's also, you know, forage fish availability and ocean conditions and the rest, but this is a sort of old growth associated species, not necessarily obligate, but pretty darn close to it. With those sorts of rates of decline in our state, I think that this department will probably be looking at, do we need to change the status at the state level from threatened to endangered, if those sorts of trends continue at an annual rate of decline of that rate. How would that trigger changes to the forest practices rules? Or would it? I think you said, what was the phrase, that species status change would trigger something?
Yes, and if I recall correctly, the rule requires that review when a species is newly listed. If it changes status, I'm not, to be honest with you right now, positive that it would mandate a review, but we would certainly promote that being on the Forest Practices Board. And in fact, the murrelet rule is slated for, it's part of the wildlife work plan that the board endorsed. And it's number two on the list of rules to review, spotted owl being number one. And we're in the middle of figuring out really what needs to be done there to complement the federal strategies, recovery plan, critical habitat, and all those moving pieces. So the murrelet is next. It's a really big undertaking to review a rule. But the department has internally looked at that particular rule in the recent past, and while it's not a perfect rule, there never is one, the murrelet rule, while it could sustain some improvements, does a fairly good job at protecting known occupied sites. So it defines habitat, and if a landowner has suitable habitat on the property under certain conditions, they have to do a murrelet survey. It's got to be blessed by us. We approve the survey efforts, et cetera. It follows the Pacific Seabird Group's survey protocol. And if it's not found to be occupied, as per the protocol, it's available for harvest. So it may be suitable habitat, but if it's not occupied, it's available for harvest. If it does become occupied, it's not available for harvest unless the landowner goes through a SEPA review. And what that then does is, the way that the rule is structured, it kind of lights up and a surrounding area around that particular stand and section. And it requires a more rigorous look at the surrounding habitat. So it does a pretty good job. Like I said, there probably are some improvements we could make. I'm not sure I can really comment on, you know, the causes of the decline. We're in discussions with Fish and Wildlife Service and our own wildlife management folks to try to get a better handle on that. But we will do that. It's just kind of a matter of when, how, who.
This is my last, and this is more of a comment. One of the real challenges, I think, with forest management, and you guys are doing a good job, and it is a cooperative discussion with other landowners and private landowners and other agencies, is but the issue is habitat fragmentation. That, you know, for a lot of our interior forest species, even if you have habitat, if it's not sufficiently buffered from edge, it's not really very functional. And I think that's one of the challenges we're seeing with marble murrelets. And that's more of a comment, recognizing the challenges we have to come up with the rules that not only protect habitat, but also from a descriptive perspective, but from an interior forest habitat condition perspective. And I think that's just a real challenge for us.
Yeah.
I know you guys are trying hard on that, but it is an ongoing issue.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. Thank you.
Commissioner Duvia.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Could you show slide 26? I was recently asked to comment on this situation. There was a case where there was a stream like similar to that in the springtime, but significant less water, and they were being requested to put in a, you know, like that one, several hundred thousand dollar barrier relief. But about 300 yards below that barrier was a 20-foot waterfall that totally made it impossible for any upward migration. How do you deal with that?
Well, our staff, when they, first of all, that water typing comes into play, of course, and even if there's a barrier downstream, if there's a permanent natural barrier downstream, they verify whether there's resident fish above it. If there's no resident fish above that permanent natural barrier, they wouldn't be able to get there on their own, then that's typically downgraded to a perennial non-fish bearing stream. So, but if there is resident fish up there, they are required to provide passage. Our bios do look at how much habitat is above a water crossing structure, because if it looks like there's really not enough to make it worth, I mean, it's a hard call to make, but if there's so minimal habitat up above a water crossing structure, that's where they may not require it to be a fish passage.
Well, there was, I don't know what the answer is, but there was 200 or 300 yards of stream where they could habitat if there was fish above it.
Mm-hmm.
It could cost $300,000 to $500,000 to put the barrier in there. There's no way the fish can come up to get more fish up there. So we would still have them put in that barrier so that they could utilize that 200, 300 yards of stream.
If there was only 200 or 300 yards of stream, more than likely they wouldn't. But I get it, it's kind of all site specific, so it's hard to say a broad brush.
Mm-hmm.
But we do definitely look at resident fish above permanent natural barriers, and then you really do have to assess the how much habitat is above that water crossing. And if it's a couple hundred yards or something, more than likely they probably wouldn't. But it's all kind of site specific.
Thank you. The other question, I've been reading some of the climate change stuff from our department, and I've also looked at some from the University of Washington's climate change people, and they're forecasting we're going to have a doubling or tripling of fires by 1240. What plans or what practices are you recommending to address the upcoming wildfires?
On private land, that tends not to be so much of an issue, forest health, because of the intensity of forest management that tends to take place on private lands. Where we get into struggles is when we have things like spotted owls rules and things like that that are very difficult to deal with in terms of maintaining habitat and compliance with ESA and all those things, and deal with forest health. But where we are really focusing our efforts on is more at kind of the policy level of working with DNR and their forest health hazard warnings. We work to the extent that we can with the Forest Service in trying to support wise restoration projects. I know the Okanagan Wenatchee is going through their forest plan revision, and they're trying to address the forest health and fire risk. But most of our work doesn't get into on-the-ground treatments of forest stands to address fire risk. one of my slides, we talked about biomass and again, the way that we work with the federal forest landowners, we try to take that into account and support, you know, projects that are going to, and even on our own lands, restore habitats, meaning on the east side, you know, fewer trees, healthier trees to try to deal with the bug infestations that only exacerbates the fire issue. But climate change is a big deal. Our department's, you know, planning for that and doing a lot of work with UW on that. And I am very interested to very soon start discussions with the forest industry to understand really how big of a threat they view climate change to their industry and what their climate change responses might be in terms of either tree densities to try to reduce fire risk and bug infestations, but also are they going to switch species? Are they going to start utilizing and planting different species, and what does that mean for habitat? So I probably didn't answer your question directly in terms of how we're going to specifically address climate change, other than, you know, we are highly involved in that arena, and climate change response strategies need to take into account fish and wildlife habitat needs as well.
And then my last question is, it seems like we're focusing, and I understand a lot of it, for ESA-listed species and providing the habitat for recovery. Well, we also have a significant problem with, as Commissioner Perry pointed out, habitat for our healthy populations so they don't become ESA. Is that your responsibility, or I mean, who do we talk to protect what we have that's healthy?
Right, and that is our responsibility. We have been historically caught up in dealing with the listings and protecting those imperiled species. We are putting more emphasis now into assessing the state and private forest landscape, in particular for the unlisted species, and to try to keep those species from being listed, because we all know what happens when they are listed, and you know, bad things happen for everybody, species included. So we're working more in kind of the priority habitats and species arena and the forest health arena to try to, especially on the east side, address forest health issues and kind of restore habitat for those species that are kind of not doing so well health-wise on the east side. So we are starting to get into that a lot more than we used to be, but the Forest Practices Board in that regulatory arena, there are legal and political challenges to doing a whole lot regulatorily for non-listed species. We work mainly through habitats, snags, logs, etc., those habitat features that are really important to a large number of species to try to keep those things off the list.
May I add to that as well? On the aquatic side, if you remember the slide that showed the riparian functions, the whole forest and fish rules are based on maintaining healthy riparian systems that do provide adequate shade for stream temperature, wood recruitment for complex habitats and not delivering sediment to the stream, and then maintaining fish habitat, fish passage, and 100-year flows in the stream morphology. So the whole rules are based on maintaining those habitats that would apply to all fish species, whether they're listed or not. And so that would help prevent more species from becoming listed as far as the aquatic side.
Okay, Commissioner Perry, you've got the last question, because we're way behind.
Yeah, I understand that. I just have one. I think you may have mentioned this, but I wanted to follow up a little bit on it. Budgets are tight for everybody, whether it's public or private sector. And assume you want people to do things that would be most effective in terms of either habitat enhancement or protection. Does your monitoring involve effectiveness of the rules that you try to implement on the ground? And if it's shows that they aren't very effective or are you willing to change those?
Okay.
From the terrestrial standpoint, there is not a lot of monitoring going on. Early on, we as a state, as a collective stakeholders in the state, did a lot more of that for things like spotted owls and marbled murrelets and those particular species. The current world is really of rule implementation and making sure that things are hitting the ground as intended. So it's a little bit different look at it. It's really more of a focus on the development, the policy of the regulations. And unfortunately, there aren't, from the terrestrial side, there's not a lot of boots on the ground doing monitoring. We do our best to assess habitat conditions before harvest, those kinds of things, to make sure that the rules get implemented properly. But after that, in terms of habitat monitoring on state and private lands, we are not involved with that. There is a lot more involved in the forest and fish side of things that your question really hits on, and I'll let Terry answer that.
And just briefly, okay.
Do any kind of adaptive management, you have to know what the effect of the recommendations are. I think that would be a major part of determining how effective the program is.
You're absolutely right. And in the Forest Practices Board's Wildlife Work Plan, it recognizes that as the fourth of the four elements. And depending upon what happens, let's say in terms of assessing a specific rule or strategy for a habitat or a species, depending upon the outcome of that, if the outcome is viewed as a little bit more resource risky, then the level of adaptive management would be going up. And if we have a lot of certainty in what we're doing, we may not need a lot of adaptive management. But we clearly recognize that in the board's work plan that that's an integral piece. When we get kind of revised solutions that come out, we will be taking a look at that and what's needed and how to fund that.
And just real quick, going back to the CEMER, Cooperative Monitoring Evaluation and Research, that's a very strong research and monitoring program. They have about $3 million a year on projects, and they have a lot of effectiveness projects on shade, stream temperature, sediment delivery, LWD recruitment. They're looking at amphibians, which our department's taken a big role in to look at how forest practices affects those riparian-dependent amphibians. So that is a very strong program, and it does factor right back into the decisions made by policy and the board on adapting the rules for those.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
Director Anderson?
In a hurry, and I'll be quick. We all are aware how important habitat is to healthy natural resources in this state. And this agency is well known for its regulations, time, place, and manner, setting seasons. We're well known for our enforcement efforts. We are not well known for the work that is being done in our habitat program and the kind of work that these two staff have briefed you on today. And a lot of their work is supported by general fund dollars, and it's incumbent on us to ensure that our constituency that value healthy natural resources understand the important role that this department plays and our habitat program plays in having healthy habitat protection, restoration, so that we can have healthy natural resources in the future, because quite frankly, if we don't do it, I don't know who is. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.